lodges. I ride in this wind on my good horse. I call you my shiny black bass, to the playhouse of fortune, to take the bright silver and gold you have taken from somebody else. And as we go riding,
you're listening to episode 693 of Unwelcome Guests, Social Destabilization Tactics Post-World War II, from Operation Phoenix to the War on Terror. In our second hour, we continue with James Gorbett's thought-provoking interview of Sibel Edmonds, and in our first hour, we hear a new speaker on the show. This is Douglas Valentine speaking about Operation Phoenix, which I hope should give us some perspective on the terror tactics and the militarization of society, which is being rolled out in the US apace after the 9/11 attacks. Now, while this may seem unprecedented, if we look from a global perspective, this is nothing new. These are tactics which, as we shall hear, have been refined since at least the Vietnam War.
I am joined right now by an expert in the CIA and DEA and their adventures in terror and narcotics trafficking. He's the author of several books on the subject, including The Strength of the Wolf, the Secret History of America's War on Drugs, The Strength of the Pack, the Personalities, Politics, and Espionage Intrigues that Shaped the DEA, and of course, the Phoenix Program. So we have Mr. Douglas Valentine. Doug, thank you for being on the show.
You're very welcome.
It's great to have you here, and I've been looking forward to having this conversation with you. And as I explained to you over an email that I sent you a while back, you know, what I'm interested in trying to piece together here, or sort of wrap my head around, is how these modern-day narco-terrorists, these notorious cartels that we hear and read so much about these days, how they may indeed connect with a program that was developed by the CIA in Vietnam back in the 60s called Phoenix, and how in studying and understanding this history, we can better understand what is happening today. So in an effort to put these pieces of the puzzle together, I suppose some background on the Phoenix program itself is necessary before we can talk about how it moved into Central America or Latin America more broadly. And I know this is no easy task, but could we begin with perhaps a summary on the essential facts on the origins of Phoenix, what we need to know before we can explore the program's expansion and how it's been implemented in other parts of the world?
Yes, but it's not an easy program to sum up in a few words.
Sure.
You know, it's a complicated thing, but I'll do my best. The Vietnam War was a unique experience for the American military and the CIA. They were fighting forces from North Vietnam, and that was what they call a main force war. At the same time, and the United States was quite prepared to fight that main force war because have the biggest military in the world, have lots of planes and tanks and all sorts of firepower. What the America wasn't prepared to fight was a guerrilla war, a political war. Ho Chi Minh had said, "I'd rather have one political cadre in a village than a battalion of soldiers out in the field." And this is what he did. He put cadre into all the villages, districts, and provinces in South Vietnam. And when I say put them there, that's not accurate. A lot of these people were there. They always were there. Ho Chi Minh and the communists were just a way that the people in South Vietnam organized themselves to fight off the oligarchy and the government, which were basically working for the Americans and following American policies. And it was this guerrilla war that was organized politically at the level of the villages and the districts that really stymied the Americans and their big brains. They didn't know how to deal with it. Mm-hmm. And the CIA started experimenting with a lot of psychological warfare methods of trying to political war and psychological warfare ways of fighting this the insurgency at the political level. And this was what they called the other war. They called it pacification. That was the CIA's job, and because it's it's fighting civilians, not soldiers. The military isn't actually allowed to go into a village and kill everybody. They're not supposed to do it. Of course, they did it plenty of times. But that job falls to the CIA. The CIA is basically a criminal conspiracy. It's not hampered by any laws, either American laws or laws of any other country. And there's nothing to stop the CIA from forming hit teams of mercenaries and special forces, its own CIA paramilitary officers, and going into the villages, finding who these civilian cadre are. They could be a school teacher, could be a union organizer, could be the mailman, could be the farmer. They're not soldiers. They're civilians who have organized against the government politically. Every once in a while, they pick up a gun or something, and they go out and fight. But mostly, they're just political people, and they're the backbone of the insurgency. They provide support for the North Vietnamese troops that are moving around. They provide support for the guerrillas who are fighting. And the CIA realizes it has to go out and kill these civilians in order to win the war. And they fool around with a lot of, they experiment with a lot of programs. They develop administrative detention laws, which allow them, and which are now used in the United States, mm-hmm. and used in the war on terror. The CIA pioneers the use of administrative detention in Vietnam in order to be able to arrest these people without charges. Because they've committed no criminal offense, Tran the farmer, or Nguyen the teacher, or Trin the union organizer. These are just civilian people. They've committed no criminal offense, but the CIA skews the law so that they can be put in prison and tortured while they're there under these administrative detention laws. It creates a whole social structure that's oppressive in order to subdue this insurgency. It builds secret interrogation centers called province interrogation centers, which are run by the secret police, and the CIA uses these secret interrogation centers to hold these people indefinitely under administrative detention laws, to ring them out, to find out who the other people in the insurgency are, to try and turn them into double agents, and send them back in and report back. It has it tries to turn everybody in South Vietnam into an informer, and of course it has its death squads, which mm-hmm. they call counter-terror teams, which the CIA calls them counter-terror teams, and basically what they do is commit terror, and they terrorize people. Like American soldiers, special forces and CIA people do in Afghanistan, in Iraq, in Yemen, in 100 countries around the world, Nile. Mm-hmm. Nowadays, in what is the modern Phoenix program, they go into homes at night with the names of people on their hit list, people who are organizing politically against them, civilians, the family members and the friends of the people in the insurgency, who are all targets as well for psychological reasons, psychological warfare reasons, go in their houses in the middle of the night, slit their throats, drag them away, kill their friends and their family, and get away before anybody knows what happened. And all this, plus a lot of other things, finally come together in 1967 when the CIA sells this method of fighting the war to the government, and that's when the Phoenix program is created, and it combines all these things that the CIA has been working on, plus a lot of other things I haven't told you about. Mm-hmm. Includes people from the military, includes people from the Army, the Navy, the Air Force, from Special Forces. It includes all the Vietnamese intelligence people, their security services, just on and on and on, and it coordinates everybody and everything that's involved in the war, and brings every resource to bear on these political people in the villages and the districts and the provinces, and the effort to wipe them off the face of the earth. That's what the Phoenix program is.
Wow. And, you know, hearing you speak about some of these tactics that the Phoenix program brought to the fore, this idea of going into someone's home at night, that's happening now, as you mentioned, in places like Iraq and Yemen, and simply taking out an entire family, associates, friends, and done so in a very public, violent way, in a form of psychological warfare. You know, The reason I bring this up, the reason I invited you on the program is because I see a lot of parallels between that, what you just described, and what is happening right now today in northern Mexico with these drug cartels. They employ the same or very similar tactics, and it's not a coincidence, as we find as we look at the history of the Phoenix program and how it transitioned into Central America, the training of those death squads, and in fact, many of the founding members of some of the more violent and notorious drug cartels in Mexico today, namely Los Zetas in Mexico, are directly linked to these death squads that were trained out of this transition to Central America from the Phoenix program. So I guess moving into Central America, so despite defeat, as it were, in Vietnam, I'm wondering why, you know, in the minds of the CIA or those responsible for constructing and implementing the strategy, was the Phoenix program in their minds considered a success or effective? In other words, why was this program exported, or why did it become the go-to strategy in El Salvador and Guatemala and later Iraq?
Well, Phoenix is a program in Vietnam, but more than that, and it's a Phoenix that goes through various organizational changes like any program does.
Sure.
Over the 8 years of its existence, pieces were put into it and taken out of it, and it was called different things. Different labels were put on the jar up on the shelf, but it's also a concept, and the concept is transferable anywhere. And it's transferable as a concept and adaptable to any situation. And the thing about the United States that you have to understand is it's never met a war it didn't like. And and that the whole America is the greatest country that the world has ever known because it has the biggest military. And it has the most effective intelligence service, the CIA, that the world has ever known. It's the biggest military and the best intelligence service because they're always engaging in what they have to do. The whole idea is that you have to always have a new generation of young men coming up and fighting, experiencing combat, fighting hand-to-hand, killing people in the most bloodthirsty fashion so that you don't lose your edge as the world's number one bad guy. So
right.
You have to realize that the United States has an imperative to always be as super as aggressive as it can so that it doesn't lose its edge. So if its impulses to dominate Vietnam seem to be stilted in Vietnam, it doesn't mean that they're not going to pop up someplace else. They're always going to pop up someplace else. And so even as Vietnam was winding down and America was beset, those of us who were alive at the time remember this very well, by the church committee and all these,
right.
You know, there were all these scandals about the CIA and all the nefarious activities it was involved in. And the military took a big hit in the Pentagon Papers because it had lied to the American public about why it was fighting the Vietnam War. It was doing it just to save face. There was no reason to fight communism. Well, during that period, the CIA had a reduction in forces. Mm-hmm. The impulse to dominate other countries was still there. So the Phoenix program became the perfect template to apply in terms of these aggressive forces that had impulses that had to come out. And by 1974, the people that had been in the Phoenix program and running it, there had been the overthrow of Chile, of Allende. In fact, one of the people who had been the station chief in Saigon, a guy named Ted Shackley, had become head of the CIA's Western Hemisphere Division in 73 and engineered the coup in Chile. And he just began placing, and so did CIA headquarters, the people who had run the Phoenix program into leadership positions within the CIA and having them direct their attention into all of Latin America. And if you review the history, you'll see that there's an infusion of American forces, covert forces, into Latin America at this time as the war in Vietnam winds down. It was, for a number of political and social and economic reasons, the place for the United States to aim its aggression at that particular point, more so than, say, Africa or Europe or even the countries in Southeast Asia, which the United States still had a presence in, but it really focused all of its aggression on South America. And the people who had been in leadership roles in the Phoenix program brought all their techniques and all their ideas into South America, including Mexico, Latin America, the Caribbean, and right in through Mexico as well, and just began applying and perfecting the Phoenix model in various ways in all these different countries. And of course, all this erupts in El Salvador, Nicaragua, and Guatemala around 1980, when all these things begin to become manifest. And once mm-hmm. again, people began to see the role in the hand of the CIA in all the counterinsurgency things that were going on in South America at that time. So there's a lot of history. But
that's, absolutely.
That's a pretty general summary of all the different forces that were coming to bear at that time.
Sure, sure. No, and for a complete understanding of everything that's going on in this part of the world at this time in history, it's probably best for those listening right now to this to do a bit of their own research and look into this and read a little further. And I would welcome anyone to do so. But again, we're sort of painting with broad strokes today for the purposes of this podcast to sort of get at, again, what is happening currently in the world today, and how this program helped to steer the military and the CIA in this direction. You mentioned just now Nicaragua, Guatemala, El Salvador, and this really is where we see in the 1980s where the war on terror and political and economic reasons sort of begin to merge with this war on drugs and the narco trafficking. It becomes much more... We get a very vivid example, in other words, with Iran-Contra. And so I'm wondering if we can speak on this a little bit. And perhaps maybe before we get into it, I did want to mention just a quick question that I had, sort of a side question. Is the Salvador option, is that synonymous with the Phoenix program? Is it essentially the same thing under a different name?
It's just for people who don't want to take one step back further in history.
Right, okay.
in fact, the people who created and imposed the Salvador option were all Phoenix veterans.
Exactly.
It's like I said, you can change the label on the jar on the shelf, but it's still the same poison.
Right, exactly. The same poison, the same concepts, as you mentioned earlier. This is what has been so pervasive and persistent within the CIA's tactics. And you mentioned in your book, the chapter that you provided that I was able to read, you mentioned Lieutenant Colonel Stan Fulcher and what he witnessed by the hand of the CIA and their proxies in El Salvador. He mentions he's quoted as saying he saw techniques, a lot of political warfare techniques, Phoenix-related subjects such as population control through psychological warfare, development and control of agent provocateurs, development of political cadres, placement of military officials and civilian security forces, prisoners put in insane asylums. Now, to me, this sounds like standard operating procedure in every theater of war that America is involved with today,
Yes, it's amazing. You have to understand, and it's very important. I was just reading a book about Daniel Siqueiros, the muralist. There's a passage where a peasant woman says that the foreman who's beating the peasant does what the hacienda owner says, and the hacienda owner does what the North Americans say. And even the peasant woman understands that the oppression is directed from North America through the landowners, and that the landowners are able to stay in business and maintain their their control of everybody and their oligarchy, because but only with the help of the North Americans. Even the lowest working class person in South America understands this. The fact that Americans don't understand it, it's just a testament to the media here.
Of course.
But everybody knows the facts on the ground in South America. In Mexico, there's a lot of anti-Americanism because they understand this, that the hand of the Americans, the CIA, the FBI, the government, the State Department has always been manipulating high officials in these countries. And they do it through a number of ways. One of those ways is the drug trafficking trade.
Mm.
Okay? And that, again, people think this is something that popped up in South America, in Central America, in Mexico. But actually, it started in China when the United States supported Chiang Kai-shek back in the 1920s. And the only way that Chiang Kai-shek could finance his government was through the opium trade. And even though there were laws against the opium business, the United States turned it, you know, a blind eye to Chiang Kai-shek's opium business because they didn't want the communists taking over. And the United States has been engaged in an unstated policy since the 1920s, which is basically when drugs were outlawed, of supporting its political allies by allowing their dealing drugs. It allowed Vang Pao and Laos to make a fortune through the opium trade. Most of the many of the generals in South Vietnam had franchises in the drug trade. This didn't come out. None of this was made public until 1971, 72, when the United States wanted to get out of Vietnam. Then all of a sudden, like with Noriega, it's, oh my God, we have a drug trafficker on our hands, and we don't want anything to do with these bad people anymore.
Yeah.
But in fact, the CIA had organized the entire drug trade out in the Far East and used it to pay off the Vietnamese generals and politicians who were following American policy against the interests of the Vietnamese or the Laotian or the Thai people. So this concept, which is integral to Phoenix, corrupting the leadership of a foreign country in order to keep the leaders in your pocket. This is an integral part of Phoenix, although I didn't really get into it in the Phoenix book. It's also transferred to South America, Latin America, and Mexico, where it's been applied before, but with the end of the Vietnam War and the beginning of Nixon's war on drugs in 1971, it escalates. And the two facets of controlling foreign leadership by corrupting them through the drug trade and then these psychological warfare techniques of Phoenix all come together in the mid-70s and with Iran-Contra sort of explode in the 1980s. So the drug trafficking and the death squads and the torture chambers, these are not things that are divorced from each other. They're integrally related.
I've read an article of yours recently in which you wrote something to the effect of, you know, the war on drugs provided the template for the war on terror. And it seems like in today's world, the two have very much merged. And as you just said, it's hard to even, you can't even separate the two at this point. They're sort of, they go hand in hand. And as you just mentioned, you know, it's very, very true that government has been in the business of protecting drug smuggling allies, as you said, or members of organized crime since the dawn of prohibition. This has always been the way it works. So it comes as no surprise that this is what's happening today. So I'm wondering, you know, what you think, to what extent the CIA is still actively involved in managing the drug trade. It would seem to follow logic that they have likely developed subtler, more subtle methods since the days of Iran-Contra and have perhaps taken a more hands-off approach instead of opting, instead now opting to work through proxies perhaps. So I'm wondering what you think about that, and you mentioned earlier also competing interests, political interests, economic interests. So, to what extent is this being done strictly for political reasons, aligning themselves with a given cartel, for example, because they have the same goal of keeping the same group of people in a given country in or out of power? How much of this relationship is based on that? How much of it is based on that almighty dollar gaining financially themselves from the narcotics trade? Your thoughts on how this plays out in today's illicit black markets?
Well, we live in a global society now.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so things are a little different than they were in the 60s and 70s in Southeast Asia. And they're a little bit different than they were in the 80s and 90s in South and Central America. And technology has had a lot to do with it. A lot of events have a lot to do with it. But certain facts haven't changed, one of which is that the illicit drug trade produces some $300 billion a year in profits. Now, that is the central fact of the war on drugs, is $300 billion that exists basically off the books until it is brought into a bank. Now, banking is an arcane trade in terms of who controls the world finances and how they do it. The dollar, of course, is the global standard. Everybody wants to have the $100 bill. And so all the majority of narco dollars, of these $300 billion a year, eventually end up in dollars and end up in banks that hold dollars. And when we're talking about a world economy in which $300 billion is floating around, it's impossible for that much money to go undetected. And the people who control, the great white fathers who control world finances, know perfectly well where it comes from and where it goes. We're talking about people who can arrange to have sanctions on Iran. And they can get into the banks of any country in the world and diddle around with their finances. It's amazing to see what they can do. It's almost impossible to explain how they do it. But that $300 billion has a lot to do with buying people's loyalty, buying their hearts and souls. And it does. And controlling that $300 billion is a very high priority for the CIA.
Absolutely. No, yeah, and I think at this point, given the what you've brought up so far, given the history of this that's readily available to anyone who's willing to look into it, I think it's very, very clear that this is still very much being managed. Why wouldn't it be by the powers that be or the powers that shouldn't be? And so the question then for me becomes, how much of what we're seeing today, as I mentioned earlier, in places like northern Mexico, how much of that violence and the tactics that were learned through the Phoenix program and the Salvador option and the training of death squads in Guatemala like the Caibiles, and incidentally, you know, the Caibiles, the founding members of Los Zetas, as I mentioned earlier, were Caibiles. Other founding members of Los Zetas were trained in the School of the Americas. These were a part of the GAFE and supposedly defected and went into the narcotics trade for themselves. So, you know, again, I'm wondering how to phrase this properly. But in your opinion, is this simply a matter of blowback? Were these individuals who happened to be trained by individuals who are linked to this Phoenix program and the tactics, and the result is what we're seeing now in the form of blowback? Or how much of this is still low-intensity warfare? How much of this is still by design? And I bring that up because the people that I've interviewed about this, namely Mr. Bill Conroy of Narco News, who's done a lot of investigative work about the drug cartels in Mexico, in his opinion, based on his research, he doesn't even consider them cartels. He considers them factions of the Mexican government itself vying for control. And so in my mind, then, by extension...
Yeah, it's
right.
A mistake to think of it as... I know Conroy, and he's
yeah.
He's got a handle on it, but it's you can't think of it as a government, first of all, because you know, it's so much more than that. You know, what do you mean by government? You know, officials in high places. Do you mean the province chiefs, the state police? You know, for nearly 100 years. Let's get to specifics. Mm-hmm. Just Mexico itself.
Okay.
The United States has had a policy of smuggling guns into Mexico, into the northern provinces, to revolutionaries and armed factions who are continuously for the last 100 years rebelling and fighting against the central government as a way of keeping the central government weak so that Mexico can never develop into a strong adversary of the United States. In other words, the United States has a policy of destabilizing Mexico.
Absolutely.
And a lot of it has to do with the fact that the government there does not represent the people. And again, it's not a government if it doesn't represent the people. So to call it a government is a misnomer to begin with.
Okay? I see.
Let's absolutely get that out of the way right away.
Sure, sure.
The United States has made sure through the arms and drug trafficking and a lot of other things that the people who ascend and succeed in Mexico are so corrupt that they will not represent the aspirations of the people. And that's American policy in Mexico and has been forever. And there's no question about it. And starting after World War II, the CIA started to, you know, affect this policy. It even the station chief down there, Winston Scott, even had Echeverria as an agent of his. And most of the presidents recently in Mexico have been agents of the CIA, working not to affect Mexican policy, but to affect American policy in Mexico. And even as I said earlier, everybody in Mexico understands that, but nobody in America understands that. And
right. The
way they do it, then they use Phoenix techniques to do it, but they don't have to have American soldiers and American spies doing it. They're able to reward individual social, economic, political groups through the drug trade to do this for them, to keep the country in a constant state of upheaval. The object is political and economic. The tactic is to socially destabilize Mexico and keep it in a constant state of violence against itself.
True.
And it's the CIA agents, they're people that do this. And whether they do it wittingly or unwittingly, it is still the hand of the CIA guiding and manipulating both the arms and the drug trade that creates the situation that, and it has even, of course, trained a lot of the special forces people who are involved in some of these cartels,
the
opposing factions have actually been trained by CIA people or people who are trained by CIA people in all these techniques and psychological warfare, torture, and so in a sense it's managed chaos, but it is very carefully and well managed. And you have to understand that the CIA has an officer in every province of Mexico, right up to the border. And in every district, in every province, there's a CIA agent. And he's working with DEA agents and FBI agents. And they're arranging to bring guns in like Fast and Furious to make sure that cartels, that these warring factions have enough guns to keep fighting. They're not interested in disarming Mexico.
Oh, no.
And this is what's been happening for, like I said, 100 years. The United States has been pouring weapons across the border in exchange for drugs. And, of course, as Gary Webb revealed, they also arrange for the delivery of the drugs in the United States and disenfranchise minorities.
Exactly. Now,
who they pit against each other and use to fill up the prisons for the same reasons.
Exactly, and I'm glad that you.
It's social engineering that's based on institutionalized racism, and people don't talk about it in the United States, but they know it and they can see it.
Yeah,
and then they but at the same time, it's very sophisticated and entrenched methods of social engineering that are behind this.
Absolutely. No, I'm very glad that you brought up Gary Webb and what is happening here in the homeland, to use the parlance of our times, the homeland, as it were. I think that's very, very true. Absolutely. Completely agree with everything you just said as far as what is happening in Mexico. You mentioned earlier the policy of the CIA is to corrupt the leaders of a foreign country and keep them in your pocket. No better example than Mexico, I think, just south of the border. Sure. And as you just alluded to, this is happening right here within our own borders. Before we get into that, because I did want to talk about that specifically, I wanted to mention just briefly again that the proof is very much in the pudding, so to speak, as far as we can talk here and speculate as far as what is happening in the CIA within Mexico and how they are indeed managing these cartels. But the history of it is all the proof that we need. And I wanted to just read a short little excerpt again from your book, because I think this will illustrate my point. You quote a Salvadoran army officer, Ricardo Castro. He was running a death squad in El Salvador, and he describes what they would do as a sort of daily routine. He says, normally you eliminate everyone. We usually go in with an informant who is part of the patrol. We turn these people in. When you turn somebody in, part of your obligation is to show us where they are and identify them. You knock on their house. They come out of their house, and we always told them we were from the left, he says, because they don't want to cooperate with us or whatever. And then we eliminated them all, always with machetes, always with machetes. Now, that right there, this is exactly, again, just to kind of reemphasize that point, this is exactly what we're seeing today in Mexico through these cartels going into someone's home, always with machetes, these exact same techniques. It's, again, not a coincidence. And so going back again to the point that you just raised, as a young kid, I was always a fan of rap and hip hop music, groups like, NWA and Public Enemy back in the early mid 90s. And back then, I remember hearing then through this music that the CIA was bringing in drugs to South Central Los Angeles to neutralize the black population. And this became sort of the stuff of urban legend. Then came Gary Webb, as you just mentioned earlier, and he introduces us and the world to Freeway Ricky Ross and among other characters that confirmed that indeed the CIA was facilitating the trafficking of crack cocaine to Los Angeles. So again, this is done for political reasons, for financial reasons, but you just hit on a point that I wanted to raise, the social engineering aspects of what the CIA does through this drug trade, how they can manufacture a crisis like the crack epidemic and introduce...
These things that we're talking about were well thought out 70 years ago. After World War II, when the United States realized it was going to emerge as the world power, even before the war was over, the writing was on the wall. And the big brains in American industry and, government were already starting to prepare for how they were going to rule the world. This is not something that a magician pulled out of a hat.
Right.
if you read the news, and Americans are surprised every day. Oh, this happened. Oh, that happened. Oh, I can't believe this. I can't believe that. Even though they saw it the day before and the year before and 10 years before that and 20 years before that, all these things have been happening, and they've all, they're always surprised by the same thing happening over and over again. But all these things and the ways that they're happening were plotted out at the end of World War II and right afterwards. And one of the things that was known, and it's in documents at the time, is that social engineering was going to be more a more potent weapon than atomic bombs. And the United States has had anthropologists and sociologists and psychologists the brightest people in these fields working for the CIA and the military, figuring out how to do this stuff. And they've got it down to a science. And it's almost the way they have perfected it. And things like the Phoenix program, which, you know, I don't get to drive the latest model. You know, it's a Lamborghini. You know, I have a Toyota. You know, I mean, and they have, you know, I was able to figure out some of these things 20 years ago, but the ways, the methods for preventing people from finding out things have also improved, and it's harder than ever to get at exactly what's going on. And you have to take and because of that, you really need a historical broad view.
Yeah.
Because if you become focused on just what's happening now, and you read the papers and you're shocked every day by what you see, you'll never understand. It has to be a kind of development of the consciousness in individuals to see this broad view, historical view, in order to be able to do something about it and to stop being manipulated by the press on a daily basis. They sort of have us trained like teenagers are trained to tweet each other, you know, and sex text each other and just look at these things that really have nothing at all to do with what's happening and how we're being controlled. And it's really important for people to take a little bit of a broader view and to try to put these things in perspective, not only to understand what's happening now, but to see where things are going to be going in the future and to be able to plot a way to deal with it.
I could not agree more with what you just said, Doug. I think that is so vitally important. The idea of taking a broader view, a more historical view to these issues, because I think that, I mean, you can just look at, you know, the scandal after scandal that's come to the surface in the past, even the past month or two, with it starting this year, and just this year alone, with you know, the news of IRS targeting certain political groups, targeting AP reporters or journalists, or the NSA scandal, Edward Snowden, so on. And if you do follow these stories as they're breaking, and you know, I'm guilty of this myself as someone who's involved with a bit of media, independent or otherwise, following news and producing a weekly show, I find myself falling into this trap at times, and having to kind of rein myself in and check myself and say, hey, you know, slow down here. Let's process this stuff again with a broader, more historical view. And I think that'll go a long way, as you just said, as far as getting a better handle on the situation, understanding what exactly is happening. These are not mistakes, as we said earlier. What we see, this interventionism overseas, these bungles, these in Iraq or Afghanistan, these aren't mistakes. This is indeed by design. And if you understand the historical context, you can better understand what exactly is happening. And I think it might take those of us who do follow news and information some degree of personal discipline and training to sort of take a step back sometimes and say, slow down, because the news cycle can make your head spin.
I mean, they call it the crisis du jour. And the media has to have a crisis du jour. You know, the news can't last more than 24 hours. You need a new headline.
There you go.
Something else to grab them, you know, but it's distracting from what's going on, you know. And of course, the partisan political politics are poison, do nothing to help, you know, here in the United States. While the bickering goes on and there's this kind of political gridlock within the government itself, the bureaucracies grow more powerful. When I first started studying the DEA and its predecessor organizations, the predecessor to the DEA was the Bureau of Narcotics, which was created in 1930. I had a $3 million budget and 300 agents up until 1968. Now there's 600 agents in New York City alone, and the drug business has become so profitable and so, in a sense, seemingly unmanageable that the DEA is now a $20 billion a year outfit that has something called a Special Operations Division, which was featured by Reuters a couple of days ago, an article about it, which I urge everybody to check out. The DEA Special Operations Division, which was created in 94 to go after Pablo Escobar, it was a unit of about 12 people. It consisted of CIA, FBI, NSA people on the Phoenix program model. And involved the latest technology and surveillance technology as a way of tracking Escobar and, you know, hunting him down with all the standard Phoenix techniques. Well, that operation, that Special Operation Division in the over the last 20 years has become this giant sort of Phoenix program nexus in the DEA with now hundreds and hundreds of agents. And not only do they monitor all trafficking in the United States the way the NSA does for under the pretext of looking for drug traffickers, but they can listen on into anybody's conversation on the pretext that that person might have something to do with drug trafficking. And right. and just like with the NSA, this information is used for political purposes and economic purposes by the bureaucrats. Mm-hmm. And these bureaucrats who run these operations for 10 or 15 years after they get out of the DEA or the CIA go to work for the corporations who benefit from the intelligence that they're gathering through these secret surveillance operations. Mm-hmm. And they're not filtering out and throwing away all this, you know, supposed extraneous information. They're using it for their personal benefits. And so it really pays nowadays to get involved in that, become a DEA agent or a CIA agent, because if you do, all you have to do is consider the American people your enemy and suckers, and you're set for life. And that's what they train them to do.
Absolutely. And, you know, you've written about this in detail as far as how the CIA infiltrated the DEA. I mentioned your books earlier, Strength of the Wolf and Strength of the Pack. Folks can look into that and find out the history of this. Again, you've written about it. And you mentioned just now, of course, the relationship between the DEA, CIA, and NSA. And speaking of scandal crisis du jour, a story that broke this week that's up everywhere. You guys can just put this up into a search engine and find it. I don't have any article up in front of me, but news broke that the NSA is indeed feeding the DEA information that they're collecting through these wiretapping programs to go after small-time drug smugglers and dealers. And that was all over the place this week. So again, you know, that sort of information to someone like you, Doug, who's been following the history of this, probably comes as no surprise at all.
Well, I would say. You know, in my book, I talk about how the NSA and the DEA were doing that in 1971, 72. You know, I mean, it's nothing new. They've been doing it forever. And any instrument that they can use, they will use. It's just that easy. What's so bizarre is that the intelligence that the DEA gets from the CIA and the NSA is inadmissible in court. And at one point, the CIA could promote a drug trafficker that it wanted to work for it as an agent by simply wiretapping that drug trafficker. Do you understand what I'm saying?
Right.
The CIA wiretaps a drug trafficker. Now the DEA can't peg him in the court. So the guy's got a license to deal. And at first, you know, the DEA was upset about that. We were going to make a case on this guy, and CIA wiretapped him. Now he can't make a case on him. Well, you know, after 10 years, the DEA saw the writing on the wall, and they just joined in with the CIA and the fun and the games. And as the CIA corrupted the DEA, the same way it corrupts a foreign government, and the CIA is corrupting the NSA the same way, that it's corrupting the military in the same fashion, the same way it corrupts foreign governments, it corrupts other bureaucracies. And this has been happening for years. And now it's gotten to the point where the DEA Special Operations Division, when it gets intelligence from the NSA or the CIA that's inadmissible in court, simply recreates on paper how they got the information. Now, this used to be a crime. If an agent in the Bureau of Narcotics did this in the 1940s or 50s or 60s, he was kicked out and fired for being corrupt. Mm-hmm. And now it's become standard operating procedure, and it's actually allowed by the Department of Justice that the DEA can lie about where it got intelligence information from an informant or a wiretap and say, well, we got it from this source when it wasn't actually that source. Present that as evidence in court. The judges won't ask to see where it came from, and the guy gets convicted and goes to jail for 20 years. The moral to the story being, you don't even have to commit a crime, and they can fudge it and make you go to jail if they want you for political purposes.
Absolutely.
You don't even have to do anything wrong anymore, because the system is so corrupted by the CIA's illegal Phoenix political kind of operations, and all these other bureaucracies have adopted it because it's effective. All these the institutions, the bureaucracies, are so corrupt and they're involved in so many illegal activities that they have to try to keep everything quiet. I'm here to tell you, you don't need to know anything more than what I've just told you.
Yeah.
They're corrupt and they're involved in illegal activities. And
exactly.
Involved in any kind of illegal activity that you can think of, and the Department of Justice will cover it up because it's effective and it maintains the same kind of social instability in the United States that CIA and the big brands in the United States have perfected abroad.
Now, earlier you called the CIA a criminal conspiracy, and I think that's absolutely true. And as you just mentioned now, this is how the social order is kept through social instability, even within our own country. And so much of what was once criminal, as you just mentioned, has become standard operating procedure. Just to emphasize your point about the information gathering and intelligence, Russell Tice, an NSA whistleblower, provided an interview to Peter B. Collins and Sabelle Edmonds of Boiling Frogs Post a few weeks back, in which he said basically that indeed all content in all our conversations, telephone, electronic, or otherwise, are indeed being collected. Everything is being stored. And not only that, but they are targeting everyone in the country, including politicians, congressmen, even Barack Obama himself when he was a senator. So anyway, just to emphasize your point again, that this is about corrupting the leaders of a country to keep them in your pocket, to keep them in line, keep them under control, either a foreign country or this very country itself. That's exactly what is happening. And I think that, again, by taking a broader perspective, a historical perspective, we can better understand that completely. And just, again, to emphasize the social engineering aspects of what we've been talking about, I wanted to just touch on this briefly because, again, just to kind of illustrate that point a little bit, the idea of the CIA bringing in crack cocaine to South Central Los Angeles in an effort to destabilize or in an effort to engineer socially the population. We can look at a program also like COINTELPRO and how it targeted political groups like the Black Panthers. And indeed, the Black Panthers, when they eventually were thoroughly destabilized and discredited and the group splintered, members of the Black Panthers went on to form the Bloods, the Crips, these gangs in South Central and other places around the country. And so again, this stuff sort of connects and explains how we've ended up in the mess that we're in. And earlier I laughed a bit when we were talking about this, but that's just a little defense mechanism of mine to keep from screaming at this insanity.
And
you know,
defense mechanism is to read Sam Greenlee's book, The Spook Who Sat at by the Door. Have you ever?
No, I haven't. No.
You know, and 40 years ago, people were aware of everything that's happening now.
Hmm.
Because it's really, nothing has changed except the bureaucracies are more corrupt and more powerful. But it's still basically the same thing. From the time the Bureau of Narcotics was created in 1930 until 1968, Black agents were not allowed to become, were never promoted above grade 12 to become grade 13 supervisors. They weren't considered fit and capable of managing white people. So the Bureau of Narcotics was an institutionally racial organization right up until 1968, run by white supremacists for the whole purpose of incarcerating blacks and Mexicans and people who the white racists looked down on as inferior. You know, it was overtly, even within the bureaucracy, a racial organization. Nothing's changed. There may be a Barack Obama president of the United States, but it hasn't changed in these bureaucracies. They're still with that purpose in mind, and despite any, you know, appearances, that's still the policy.
I understand. Yeah, you know, and I want to close on this note before I let you go here. I'm wondering if it's okay with you if I read a little bit from that final chapter of the Phoenix program. I don't want to give away any spoilers. This is the last chapter of your book. I'm wondering if it's okay with you, because I think perfect way to end this conversation, because I like folks listening to listen to what I'm about to read and consider what is happening, not just in other parts of the world today, but what is actually happening within our own borders. So you finish the book with this statement. It says, and where can Phoenix be found today? Wherever governments of the left or the right use military and security forces to enforce their ideologies under the aegis of anti-terrorism, look for Phoenix wherever police checkpoints ring in major cities, wherever paramilitary police units patrol in armored cars. This sounds like Boston just a few months ago. And wherever military forces are conducting counterinsurgent operations, look for Phoenix wherever emergency decrees are used to suspend due process, NDAA, anyone. Wherever dissidents are interned indefinitely, again, NDAA, anyone. Wherever dissidents are rounded up and deported, look for Phoenix wherever security forces use informants to identify dissidents, wherever they keep files and computerized blacklists on dissidents, NSA, anyone. Wherever security forces conduct secret investigations and surveillance on dissidents, surveillance on forces, thugs in their hire, harass and murder dissidents, wherever such activities go unreported by the press. So again, just take that in. And again, consider what is happening not just around the world, but within this country and the supposed land of the free and home of the brave. So, Doug, your final thoughts on this before we wrap this up. And please do mention where people out there listening can read more of your work and perhaps buy a copy or two of your books.
Well, I would just say that it's a matter really of consciousness, you know. It sounds like a fakey term or a fakey word, but ultimately, not being frustrated and wondering what can I do, but becoming conscious of the situation, you know, the things that you have to do will appear magically. Before you, if you become aware of the situation, you'll see the way out.
Excellent.
Thank you very much.
Oh yeah, thanks for being here again, Douglas Valentine. And I should have mentioned this before I read this, but that the Phoenix program is what I just read an excerpt from it, and that was published back in 1990. So just to give you an idea of how things have come along in this country since then. So again, Douglas Valentine, DouglasValentine.com is the website where you can find out more and read more of his work. This has been Demanufacturing Consent. I am your host, Guillermo Jimenez, reminding you, as always, that on this grand chessboard, it is we, the people, who are now in check. It's our move.
And the full interview is 64 minutes, available on YouTube. It was posted on December the 6th, 2013. I just removed the hesitations and silences and managed to squeeze it into 50-something minutes. Now we continue where we left off last time. This is James Corbett interviewing FBI whistleblower Sybel Edmonds.
Let's move back into the context, specifically in talking about